for better and for worse, fear. The Taliban don't have modern technologies by Western standards, but they have something like asabiya. They have warrior spirit, less of a fear of dying in combat and these kind of things. I think once they've taken office, there is a general sense of like, you don't mess with the government.
Hello and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. As you can tell by the fact that I'm doing the introductions here and not Ruri, we've got a guest today. Today I am joined by YouTuber, academic, and entrepreneur Sean McFadden, who, you know, his name might not indicate it, but he actually does have some relevant experience and some stories to tell about Afghanistan. Today, we're going to be engaging in a bit of reminiscence on the issues facing Afghanistan and hopefully a bit of an update as well. I mean, how have things changed in the 2 years since we've left? Hello, Sean.
Hi, Rob. Good to be here. I'm glad to be given some of my experience and some of my knowledge.
Well, first off, I guess, do you want to just sort of talk a bit about your family background and how that connects to Afghanistan?
Right. So, as you've already said, my name doesn't really sound very Afghan. My father is from Ireland. So my family from my father's side are from Ireland. But my mother is from Afghanistan, from the eastern side of Afghanistan, the Hindu Kush Mountains, ethnic group called the Pashtuns, which is the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. And yeah, they all came here in the beginning of the 90s. Most of my immediate family came to Germany in the early 90s after the collapse of the Soviet puppet regime in Afghanistan. It ended around the end of the 80s, and then there was a bit of a transition phase. And then there was basically half a decade of civil war. And in the beginning of all that, most of my family came here. I still had some relatives there or even going back there to try and build something up in the last regime. I mean, the Islamic Republic, the one backed by the Americans under Hamid Karzai and Ashraf Ghani. But most of my immediate family have now left the country. But I still maintain some contacts there.
Would it be fair to say that you've probably not actually been to Afghanistan yourself, or have you visited?
I have gone. I've gone a couple times. Yeah, I've gone to Kabul and I've traveled a little bit. Gone to see the area my family's from, where my grandparents were born, and all that.
So the fall of the sort of U.S.-oriented government sounds like it was a trauma for your extended family, to say the least.
Yeah, it depends. A lot of the people that have left the country long time ago, like my immediate family that left in the early 90s, they've kind of built up a bit of a, you could say, unfortunate passivity towards the topic. I remember when I was young, a lot of them would still follow the news and always try and hear what news there are from Afghanistan. But with time, it kind of got less because there was just no good news ever coming. And a lot of people in my family, I think, had grown a bit apathetic or a bit kind of consciously disinterested to not, you know, just be upset all the time. So I feel it obviously was like another kind of re-emergence of the topic when the Taliban took over, but I think by then the interest and the focus on the country had kind of declined a bit with time.
That's a fascinating microcosm of just like the immigrant experience more broadly. My family, I guess the most recent ethnic background we have that is not the United States is Polish.
Okay.
And sort of throughout the Cold War, we didn't even mention it. Like it was just so far because as you said, the news was always bad. There were, at least from the United States context, there wasn't much to be, for lack of a better word, proud of or to highlight. And then it was only after the fall of the Berlin Wall and sort of the end of the whole Eastern Europe communist bloc thing that we started provisionally trying to recover our roots there a little bit. But honestly, it's sort of too late because on our parts, it was a couple generations at that point. So you have like family members who are contemporaries in like with Afghan roots, but not really having grown up there at all? Is that a similar...
It's a mix. There's quite a spectrum in my generation of in terms of age range. So I have a range of cousins that were born there, spent some time there, some of which were there until they were 16, 17. And I've others that were entirely born here, like I was. So it's a bit of a spectrum. And of the ones born here, as far as I know, I was the only one that ever went there to visit.
Interesting. So it sounds like you've made a serious effort to retain connection, or at least the knowledge of what's going on.
Yeah. So I think the major aspect of this was me retaining the language. I did grow up speaking Pashto, and I did maintain speaking it and learn to read and write, at least on a basic level. And that naturally allowed me to follow Afghan media, allowed me to just consume more content and news about the country, and also keep me more interested, because I kind of would feel less of a tourist. I'd be able to speak to people. And especially the fact that for most of my life, I'd never seen the country, just made it like this kind of, it gave it a kind of mystique, especially because on top of never seeing it, it was also this kind of distant, war-torn problem country, right? That no one I know ever went to, you know?
What is the Afghan sort of media landscape like, or at least just what is your window on it? Like what kind of media do you consume? Has that changed dramatically now that the Taliban are back in power, or?
It depends. Like there's a mix of things. As far as I know, there's quite some popularity with like content creators on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, actually.
Well,
so my theory about that is that you don't actually need to, and I don't mean that like in a derogatory way, but you don't actually need to be literate to use TikTok. So I feel like a lot of the working class or lower classes in developing countries would actually struggle to read, which is not the case necessarily in European countries or such. But, and I think there's just a large group of people that you open up access to social media with something like TikTok.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, we certainly lament in the United States a lot the influence of TikTok or you know, more and more people getting their news exclusively from TikTok. But I guess that's a somewhat different situation where that's the only option that people have.
Yeah.
At least in the U.S., you could think, well, you know, people, you know, maybe we'll ban TikTok. Maybe people will sort of straighten up and fly right. But it's that's fascinating. So you follow Afghan TikTokers or?
No, I was just kind of given a description. I have to say, me personally, I stay away from TikTok. But that's just on the social media landscape. I would say on TV, there is loads of channels that look like they're kind of copying things like BBC or CNN. You can imagine it a very similar way. There's a news anchor with a serious voice,
sure,
wearing a suit and just giving the news. There's a lot of like entertainment stuff, usually translated, dubbed shows from India, these kind of things. They used to have them with like a lot of the women censored from below the neck. But even that, I think, got cancelled and been replaced with a lot of just kind of prayer. It's just news and prayer.
Mm.
A lot
news
of that.
And prayer.
So I don't follow it that often. I'm just basing that off of like going to my grandma's house and watching TV with her and things like that. So that's just the little insight I got there.
Your grandmother's in Germany as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Are there still female news anchors?
I think so. I've seen some, but I don't take my word for it now, because I'm not sure whether some of these channels are actually kind of based in like Qatar or London or something. So I'm not fully sure if the female news anchors I've seen are channels that are actually based in Kabul or something. But I have seen female anchors, yeah.
So you're in your mid-20s. So I guess like as you became aware of Afghanistan, you know, sort of one of the places your family is from, I guess it was sort of always under U.S. occupation. Is that a fair characterization?
As long as I can remember, right? I mean, I don't remember 9/11. So as long as I can remember, it was under American occupation. When I went there last, it was just at the end of that occupation. So it was actually kind of the most dangerous time. Thinking back, a lot of choices I made may have not been the safest. After all, like, I'm still here, so I was lucky and all that. But it was kind of very, very new for me to see a kind of an era end, a transition into a new regime, which, I mean, relatively speaking, happens quite often in Afghanistan compared to, like, you know, Germany or something.
Comparatively speaking.
But yeah, it was something very, very new and different to see. And I remember, I think I was in Ireland at the time when it then actually happened. And I called up a cousin of mine. I was like, hey, what's up? I'm seeing, like, awful stuff on TV. What's going on? And he's like, oh yeah, I've got a bit of a regime change. And I was like,
this is a cousin in Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, okay, and what are you doing now? And he was running an NGO, and he was like, I don't know, really. I'm just gonna wait it out and see if they're interested in my NGO. And I was like, so you're not fleeing? You're not, like, getting evacuated or anything? And he was like, nah, I just wait it out and wait until the dust settles, and then just check with them if they have any interest in the NGO. If they don't, they'll have to come back.
Did they have any interest? Did the Taliban have any interest in the NGO?
No. No interest, no money, no nothing.
Yeah.
So
I think no money is definitely a developing theme in modern Afghanistan. But before we get to that, so it's interesting to see you there. You were there, like, what, 6 months, a year before the fall, 2 years, something like that?
Yeah, even less, I'd say. Like maybe. So the fall was in August, was it? I think it was in August 2021. Yeah. I think it was there around February.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this would involve going to Kabul and then visiting where your mom was from. Were those territories sort of contested at that point? Because Pashto areas were the ones where were Taliban strongholds, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Taliban are Pashtuns. Most of them are Pashtuns. As far as I know, the old regime from until 2001 were exclusively Pashtuns. I think even exclusively from one or two tribes.
Oh, really? Interesting.
And the current regime is a bit more multicultural and diverse. So I'd say they're still majority Pashtun.
How did that happen? How did they become more diverse? Just a broader section of Afghans angry at U.S. occupation? Or?
I'm not sure. I don't have a good answer for that. I would say it's part of a broader general improvement in their strategy. So I think the first regime was kind of generally isolated. It didn't have many friends outside of some people in Pakistan. Whereas the new version of the Taliban, they do have some, I think, solid connections in Qatar, for example. So they do have a more, let's say, thought through structure. And I have the feeling it could be a tactical thing to kind of keep the areas that are almost exclusively non-Pashtun, to keep them better under control, is to have at least some representation, have someone that they can identify with within the Taliban. They even had someone of the Hazara, which are, like, the most, you could say, oppressed group to some extent. But that ended a year back or something. I think there's no Hazara member in the Taliban anymore.
Because Hazara would be Shia. Is there a one-to-one connection there? Or because that was my...
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah.
Understanding why they're such a put upon minority and so directly targeted by the Taliban, less so now probably that the Taliban is in charge, but specifically by ISIS-K, right? They're large victims. That's fascinating. I think it's important to remember that this is Taliban's second go round at this. I mean, it is a rare thing that takes a certain extreme level of incompetence that really only the modern U.S. military industrial complex is capable of to defeat a entity as thoroughly as the Taliban were defeated in 2001, and then allow them to resurrect themselves entirely. And it does seem like the Taliban is using this opportunity in some respects. I mean, the jury remains out, but in some respects, they do seem to be learning a few things.
Yeah, exactly. And then to get back to your question, some of the provinces of the Pashtuns, specifically going into the valley, the Hindu Kush valley, provinces such as Kunar and Nuristan, they were disputed. Kunar was mainly, as was the case with, I think, most of the provinces for a while, actually, the capitals, the main cities of those provinces were government-controlled, were republic-controlled, and the main roads to these cities, and that was pretty much it. I think it had been years, even before their takeover, that most of the countryside, most of the areas leaving the main roads were already more or less under Taliban control. And so in Kunar was the same thing. You had government control, republic control until the capital, Asadabad, or the locals would refer to it as Cherasre. And north of it, you'd have disputed areas then between government and Taliban. And yeah, these are, as you said correctly, mostly Pashtun areas. But the thing is with the Pashtuns is it is, I think, I read it somewhere. It's a, like a Wikipedia level source I'm citing here. That the Pashtuns are the biggest or one of the biggest tribal societies left today. So Pashtuns are an ethnicity, but they're still divided among various tribes. So, for example, the Safi Pashtuns that we would be part of, as far as I know, there are not many Safi Pashtuns represented in the Taliban either, for example. Interesting. Most of the Safi Pashtuns would be farmers in Kunar. And so, yeah, the even dialects would vary a lot, which, I mean, is still the case in European countries, but I'd say it's probably more extreme due to the lack of standardized education in a lot of areas. The difference in dialects would be more severe, because before I started working as a translator in Germany for refugees, I wouldn't be familiar with other dialects. I'd only know the dialect of my family. And then the first time I remember I had to deal with, you know, Kandahari Pashto, I actually barely understood anything. And that was a shock to me, as it was meant to be the same language.
Are you still doing work with refugees in Germany?
I haven't since I moved for college. I kind of stopped as I got more busy with other things, but I did do it for a good bit of 5 years, I'd say, since I was 17 until I was 22, 23, 5 or 6 years.
And I mean, do you have a sense on how German migration is, sort of a bit off topic, but it is a fascinating issue that I've always been quite curious about. Do you have a quick take on the progress of integration of sort of the 2015 era refugees in Germany? Or
right. Yeah, that's a difficult topic in Germany, because I've had many people say to me from other countries as well, like Britain and France, that Germany doesn't really have a kind of civic nationalism, you could say, like, you know, as opposed to an ethnic nationalism, right? So you could say that, like, in Britain, you'd have something like an ethnic nationalism of the Scots, of the English, but you also have a civic nationalism of the British, you know? And so in England, you can see people of Indian origin, of Pakistani origin. You will see some with the Union Jack celebrating the coronation, things like that, right? And you'll hear them speak, and they speak better English than most of us. And in Germany, there is a bit of a lack of that, probably due to historical reasons, probably various factors, the, like, you know, negative history with nationalism, plus maybe the fact that the country was divided for so long, and a not fully succeeded reunification and all that contributes. And so there is a bit of a lack of this kind of civic nationalism that you can just join, you know, that you can join as a foreigner and then be patriotic for Germany as a foreigner, outside of maybe football. That is a bit of a problem in Germany, in terms of you'll have people that are born here or even here for generations, and you'll still hear a foreign accent, there'll still be a bit of a distance. Obviously, things have improved in some ways. There's the, for example, the job market, as far as I know, is doing relatively well. I just checked it today. Coincidence. It's doing relatively well, as far as I know, most refugees or asylum seekers that enter Germany after a certain amount of years, they basically have an employment rate that is on par with the national average. So the kind of system, the bureaucratic system in Germany is not perfect, but there's probably worse around. But the cultural aspect I see is problematic. I have the impression, from my anecdotal experience, that Germans, even if they have a liberal mindset or an open to multiculturalism kind of mindset, they don't in practice really spend much time with foreigners, asylum seekers, these kind of people.
I spent 6 weeks in Berlin a number of years back, and I don't think I met any Germans. They're hard to find. But back to Afghanistan. So do you have like a consciousness of like how sort of an ebb and flow in the fortunes of the U.S. occupation government, you know, the way that your family members were talking about it, was it just always a basket case?
I don't have a feeling of it. I only have stuff I've read about. As far as I know, there was a time period in the very beginning where it kind of seemed like people were trying to figure stuff out. I think one should make a difference between Hamid Karzai and Ashraf Ghani as well in terms of their leadership. I'm not in any position to judge their character. But Ashraf Ghani seems like someone who, regardless of his moral character, was skilled for a terrain as rough as Afghanistan. He was skilled to navigate such a, let's say, threatening, dangerous, rough terrain as the political landscape in Afghanistan. And he did, as far as I know, criticize the fact that any kind of groups that were affiliated or were seen to be affiliated with the Taliban were excluded from any initial government building conferences.
So he criticized that. He wanted to bring the Taliban in from the beginning.
Yeah, he criticized that. The Americans basically vetoed that. Whereas if you look at Ghani's time, it was kind of, it's not necessarily even his fault. It's kind of just a symptom, or he just kind of symbolized the kind of decline of that regime, because Ghani was way more the archetypal Western kind of bureaucrat, which is just fundamentally unfit to rule a country as rough as Afghanistan.
Yeah.
He was bound to not really be in charge. And they kind of, I'd say they're good symbols for how things were going, but it was already going downhill badly at the end of Hamid Karzai's rule. Yeah, so there was this initial gold rush, you could call it like a foreign aid gold rush that many people in my family weren't particularly fond of, because it meant a lot of like expats, foreign people from Afghanistan and foreign countries going back to quickly make money, as they're superior to the average local in education and general connections, their passport is better and all that. So they would go back and make a lot of money, and it'd be kind of an industry where that money just end up abroad and wouldn't really help a lot locally. The corruption in general was also just rampant. I think even Ashraf Ghani once said that they don't see most of the money getting there. As far as I know, most of the foreign aid was given to USAID. And USAID was then responsible in distributing it. And what would happen in practice is that I don't know if that's USAID or contractors, subcontractors of subcontractors or whoever.
But that's exactly how it goes. I remember this from Syria as well. There's a certain sum of, a very large sum of money the first division is like most of the money goes to military agencies, the Department of Defense. Then USAID gets a chunk of money that still looks pretty good, still looks pretty big. And then they hire Chemonics, and then they hire subcontractors, Chemonics, and it's funny, like that gold rush in Afghanistan is probably like 10% of the actual money, because so much of it has already just never left Washington, D.C. with their subcontractors. I had friends who living in Istanbul who got to be pretty successful as subcontractors. And they were actually, you know, doing some program delivery, doing some assessment, this, that, and the other thing. But there were three layers of organizations above them that were not local, weren't even in Istanbul. We're just sitting in Washington, D.C. collecting checks. So, long-established grift.
Yeah. And to this whole kind of economy, then relatively late in the game, around 2019 already, I think, my relative kind of started his NGO, he was first researching what to do and figured out that there was no good numbers on the country. So he just decided to have an NGO that does research and, you know, does get those numbers on, you know, election polling, opinion polls, income, ethnicities, different kind of questions. Basic data collection. And that was in that context, I went there my first time, where he wanted me to kind of help him. He wanted someone who had good English, who could kind of present it on a more international kind of level and a more international serious kind of level. And I was basically flown in with 3 days' notice to give a speech at a press conference there that was actually transmitted on TV on several channels there. Very random, very wild, a great story to tell at parties. And later on, there was another project on air quality measurements. And the problem was that during the winter, people would be burning tires and shoes and plastic waste and things like that, so that when winter came, all the measurement devices would max out at 999 and become basically useless because the air was so polluted you couldn't really do a proper study. And I really noticed that when I was there, and I'd wake up every morning and basically cough like black mucus into my tissue. Very bad situation. You'd see a lot of people in like half broken down buildings or half finished buildings, and they'd be living in there, but in tents, right? With families with many kids. So the level of poverty and the level of dilapidation was pretty severe, something I've never seen in my life before.
And this is when at a period of time where nominally tens of billions of dollars are flowing into the Afghan economy from the U.S. every year. Nominally.
From the U.S., from the EU, from everywhere. But that money, like, sadly enough, if I'm honest, there was buildings that, like, some of the best buildings still standing were built by the Soviets still. Like the building my parts of my family lived in were still there, and they still had like running water and things like that. I mean, you had a blackout like 3 or 4 times a day, and water would kind of cut off now and then. But compared to a lot of other buildings, it was still in good infrastructure. And the reason my family lived there was some of my family members were affiliated with the communists. My grandfather supported Dawood. Dawood was a relative of the king, the last king of Afghanistan, Zahir Shah. He was the longest reigning king, the longest phase of peace, so to say, from 1933 to 73, I think. And then his relative did a military coup and kind of installed a typical for developing countries, a strange hybrid political system that you cannot really classify. The Dawood was kind of like a monarch, kind of like a fascist dictator. The ideology was kind of socialist. It's kind of like a mix of a lot of recycled ideologies that end up.
This is in the 70s before the Soviets came in?
Yeah, exactly. And my grandfather worked for them. And then there was another coup done by Amin in the mid-end 70s, as far as I know. And then...
And that was the more forthrightly communist one, right?
Yeah. There was two parties. Both were kind of socialists. Parcham, they were more supporting Dawood. And Khalq, which is like the People's Party. Don't know, maybe you could call them roughly Stalinist or something. And they were more severe. They'd have harsh measures to basically destroy traditional property rights tied to, you know, tribal leaders and things like that. And yeah, so my grandfather actually had to flee the country when they took over. He was even, my mother hid him under the kitchen counter when they came looking for people, members of the Parcham party. And she helped him then flee. And he lived in exile in Pakistan for, I think, a few years until the Soviets came, which is when he was allowed back and he got a position in the Soviet-run government.
Ah, I can see why your family had to leave in the 90s.
Yeah. That was then. Yeah, the Soviet government, in some sense, was similar to the recent republic, insofar that the president was a bit of a puppet, you could say. Babrak Karmal, he was a bit of a Soviet puppet, in a similar way as Ashraf Ghani was an American puppet. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but it's just kind of, you know, the truth.
I don't think anyone would really, really dispute that. It is interesting, and I think we had discussed this earlier, just how mystifying it is that we just sort of went there and stayed. We won in Afghanistan, I'd argue in large part because of the support of the Iranians before we decided they were evil. But we very, very quickly, in the fall of 2001 and the beginning of 2002, like very, very quickly, control over all of Afghanistan, the Taliban was more or less completely defeated, with a lot of Iranian help. And then we just sort of stayed there, apparently employed a collection of the worst possible people. I'm not speaking about Karzai or Ashraf Ghani, but just like as we go lower down the scale, just, you know, all of our worst warlords from the 80s, just a real selection of just awful, awful people who did a terrible job running the place. And gave the Taliban a new lease on life. I mean, there are accounts you read where you have like Taliban fighters who are like, oh, well, I guess we're done. And, you know, who spent 2002 and 2003, you know, trying to figure out how to farm again until they realized that the Americans, A, weren't leaving and B, were empowering some of the worst people in the country. Does that characterization seem fair or is that...
That's very fair. Like I said, we had unimaginable corruption, but that wasn't it. The reason the Taliban got so powerful again is almost for the same reasons they got powerful in the first place. So just to continue where I left off with my family story, it's like when the Soviets left, there was like a leftover republic in Afghanistan led by Mohammad Najibullah. He's often referred to as Dr. Najib. And a lot of people from that generation that left the country, they see him as a kind of a saint or like a, you know, a the last true leader of the country or something like that.
Well, he lasted a lot longer than anybody expected, right? Didn't he last until like 97 or something? Like,
No, I think he died in the early 90s, 91, 92. He didn't last very long, I think. Yeah, he got publicly executed in Kabul, which was often blamed on the Taliban, which now at this point I'm not sure if it's even true, because as far as I know he was open for negotiations. He was open to step down. He was open to entirely renegotiate the government, which is why he was seen as a good leader, in the sense that he wasn't there to just hold on to power and kill his opponents. But yeah, he had some motivation to renegotiate the regime, create an independent Afghanistan.
Yeah, he was killed on September 27th, 1996.
96, okay, so he did last longer than I thought, yeah. But as far as I know, he wasn't in power anymore.
There were a lot of very confident folks in Washington, D.C. who were like, ah, well, the Soviets have left, which I believe was 1989, and clearly, it's the country is going to, you know, fall into the hands of our allies, and it ended up taking it ended up taking half a decade, because in fact the people we had been supporting quickly, you know, were not great people, and quickly fell to fighting among themselves.
Yeah. So that was the thing. People now have told me, people I trust, that it wasn't actually the Taliban that killed Dr. Najib. It was potentially Pakistani Secret Service or whoever, but that's beside the point. What happened effectively was a very, very vicious civil war that led to population decline, led to a complete disintegration of the country. You had rampant human trafficking, child trafficking, drug trade, weapons trade, a lot of very, very despicable behavior of some of those warlords that were there.
I'm not generally a fan of the U.S. isolationists. You know, we need to be more involved everywhere all the time. But Afghanistan in the 1990s, I think, is one of those examples that sort of that I do believe in. I mean, we did so much to help destroy the place in the 80s. Sorry, set it free. And then as soon as we had accomplished our goal, which is humiliating the Soviets, we just pulled out entirely if we weren't, you know, still surreptitiously arming, you know, some of the worst people. And just like that, if you want to look at a real one of them, the few very concrete precursors or things that we did that led to 9/11, it was just abandoning Afghanistan wholesale in the 1990s to a truly horrific. I mean, honestly, the 90s civil war is probably worse than the U.S. invasion and an occupation. Is that fair to say in terms of loss of
probably,
life? And,
probably. I mean, that is kind of what led to the rise of the Taliban in the first place, right? So you had these people that the U.S. supported in the 80s in what was called Operation Cyclone. Some of
Sounds
these
right.
warlords, a lot of these warlords were essentially ethnic warlords, right? That most of their fighters would be from their respective ethnic group. You had Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was a Pashtun. You had Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was a Tajik. And you had Rashid Dostum, who was an Uzbek, which is the three biggest ethnic groups, you could say. In the end, they also used those people to take back control. The so-called Northern Alliance was an alliance with Ahmad Shah Massoud and later Dostum. And those people were given then positions. I mean, Massoud was killed in 2001, so he didn't end up having some position in the new regime. But Dostum always maintained some position there, despite many, many crimes, despite him being accused of genocide, more or less, or at least like crimes against humanity. There was a deal struck.
Just like mass executions of Taliban, right?
Yeah. There was a deal struck, I think, somewhere where the U.S. kind of erased his record as his record of crimes against humanity, just for practical reasons. Same with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. He I think, engaged in a very bloody siege of Kabul in the 90s, and I think in 2016, until 2016, he was affiliated with the Taliban, and then they also struck a deal with him where, in exchange for erasing his track record of crimes against humanity, he would join the Republic, and then ended up being a presidential candidate in 2019. Yeah, he ended up being, he only got 2% or something, but yeah, he ended up being a presidential candidate. I don't know what he's doing now, but he's been around for a long time. I remember him being on TV during the election at my grandmother's house, and my mother would be like, "That guy is still around."
I think Dostum is still alive, but didn't he have to flee or something? I can't.
Oh yeah, he's got to flee. Like, there's no way he could stay. He could set foot in Afghanistan now anymore. He's got to flee. But like, these were some of the worst people. These were the people engaged in the human trafficking, in the like horrible destructive drug trade. These were the people tearing the country apart during the civil war, and then among them, the Taliban rose as a force for law and order, and that is essentially a large part of their appeal. I read, there's a German journalist I like that I follow, that I like his books. He's very well-versed on the Middle East. His name is Michael Lüders. Unfortunately, I don't know if all of his books are translated. He's not that... I haven't met many people that know him outside of Germany, but he described the phase as essentially being a kind of liberation movement from a lot of these warlords. That it started off in Kandahar with the local warlord that was abusing children, as far as I know, being executed, and that kind of making the rounds, that message being spread that they killed him and that they're going around killing anyone that engaged in those disgusting acts, and that a lot of people just volunteered and joined them and started killing them. And then at some point they got the attention of Pakistani Secret Service, and then slowly the funding came in and the weapons came in.
It is interesting just to consider that, I mean, they were really only in power for 5 years before 2001. Something that I think a lot about with just sort of radical religious regimes is that it always fades. It fades pretty quickly, in fact. You can look at the various, I mean, you can tell any story you want about the Islamic Republic of Iran, but I tend to lean towards a generalized sense that religion seems to be fading fairly quickly there. And they've gotten, even by the 1990s, they were a lot more interested in engagement than in sort of radical revolutionary orthodoxy. And I think the Taliban, it's just the part of why they made such perfect villains in 2001 is because they were still, you know, they hadn't gone through that process. They were still very fresh. And it's kind of crazy to think that by what, 2026, they will have been in power longer this time around than they were the first time around, which is kind of crazy.
Well, another point, I think, is the global isolation. I mean, the Iranian regime is under sanctions, but the Taliban regime is not recognized, which in many ways is worse than sanctions. And this kind of relationship also extends the initial phase, so to say. It does drag it out. You know, you may be claiming to be doing that in support or in solidarity with the women in the country, but the effect of it is no change in the regime and more women starving. So that also drags it out. And I don't think they were even recognized last time they were around. That, I think, is another issue when it comes to the Taliban.
Yeah, that's a huge, I mean, that's part of why what we're doing to Venezuela is so devious, is that we essentially delegitimize them entirely by saying, actually, you're not the real government. There's a different government that's actually the real one. And I guess it's a sign of the Taliban's success. I know there was certainly some noise. You know, Lindsey Graham was talking about, well, you know, Massoud's kid is in a valley somewhere and we're going to recognize them as the government or something along those lines. But it does seem like none of that's really gone anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have that symbolic power that his father had. He doesn't look like a warrior, even like his father was. Yeah. I don't want to. It's a very controversial topic because he is seen by a lot of people as like another kind of hero figure, and his face was everywhere in the Republic. There was posters of his face everywhere. A lot of like kind of Gandhi style kind of pictures, you know what I mean, with quotes, or Martin Luther King kind of style pictures. I can say just anecdotally, in my family, he's not popular. He's seen as another just kind of warlord thug. I don't know enough about the man to make a clear judgment, but I wonder if a lot of his kind of symbolic value was an actual like propaganda effort during the last 20 years. And I'd like to know if there was some way to reconstruct it, whether he had that same power to his name before he died.
Yeah, I know Massoud was, I mean, he certainly had his partisans. The father who died in 2001 had his partisans. Steve Cole wrote the book on the run-up to 9/11, and he was sort of seen as a more heroic figure. And, you know, what if he had lived, or this, that, and the other thing? But what any of that's relation to reality is, who's to say?
I'd like to know one thing, what your opinion on one thing, because I personally don't buy the excuse of harboring Osama bin Laden for starting the war to some extent, because as far as I've read about it, they were in talks, they were negotiating, they were saying that they would deliver bin Laden given proof that he was involved in 9/11. Later on, when it looked like the U.S. was going to invade, they were even ready to deliver him without proof, just deliver him like that. Yet it seemed like they were going to bomb Afghanistan anyways. Kind of, it seemed to me like that. Would you agree with that, or would you
Oh, I'd 100% agree with that. Like, there's no question that, you presented two options there. What if we had said, like, hey, you know what? We'll recognize you, or we'll let the World Bank give you a big loan. Give us Osama bin Laden. I would assume that the Taliban at that point, even just, 4 years away from its founding radicalism, would have been like, yes, sir, we wanted blood. And that was the, I mean, we Afghanistan had, unlike Iraq, a conceivable sort of documented connection to what had occurred on September 11th. And, the fact that there was no such connection didn't stop us in Iraq. We wanted blood, we wanted destruction, and we got it. And honestly, I think the most disappointing thing from the Bush administration's perspective was initially how easy it was to take Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, it's so far away. Like, for how many Americans could point at Afghanistan on a map? It's so far away. And who that isn't like you and me that really, gets, like, reads up on these things, who could really tell you the difference between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, right? Like, who would be able to tell you the difference, right? There is a difference. They were really not the same thing. The Taliban probably would have been happy to just throw them under the bus if it helped their regime, but no one knows that.
Well, in the U.S., there were a lot of people who were working hard to erase the very real massive differences between sort of secular nationalists like Saddam Hussein and Al Qaeda. So they're both traditionalists. It was a lot easier to make those direct connections.
Yeah. Bin Laden even offered to wage jihad against Saddam, right? If I remember correctly.
Sure, in the first Gulf War, yeah, in 1991. And I think that was sort of the beginning of his final break with the Saudis, when the Saudis invited the U.S. in instead of using his Afghan jihadists, who I think probably would have gotten annihilated by Saddam's military.
They wouldn't have had a good chance.
I think it's worth talking now about how Afghanistan's doing now. And I think initially it probably makes sense to talk about the incredible burdens that have been placed on this country. During the period of occupation, I was reading something this morning, 60% of GDP, or was it just the government's budget, came for either one. Came from foreign aid.
Yeah.
That's not entirely. I assume the UN's still in there providing food aid or whatever, but most of it's gone. One of the most outrageous acts of the Biden administration, truly horrific. We basically stole their central bank. So they had the way that central banks work and their reserve currencies is they're often deposited in foreign institutions, most often in the United States. Afghan government had a central bank with reserve funds in the United States, and we basically said, oh, you kicked us out? We'll take your central bank money. And what that has done to the stability of the currency, to the Afghan economy, is atrocious. Just to sort of imagine if somebody just appropriated the Federal Reserve and all of its resources. That's what we did.
You missed out the second part. Didn't he donate half of that money to 9/11 victims' families or something like that?
So that's another atrocity. So yeah, so half of it is meant to be the big deal they proposed that is still locked up in litigation was that half of it was going to go to 9/11 victims' families, and then half of it was going to go into that USAID funnel. So imagine, that we were talking about earlier, we're gonna do humanitarian stuff for Afghanistan through that. We're gonna find a way to keep paying all these people that ran off with all the money that was intended for Afghanistan for 20 years, which is just absolutely outrageous. Basically, essentially saying we're gonna keep this humanitarian aid industrial complex going for another couple of years with the central bank funds that are necessary to Afghanistan to continue to operate an economy and feed anybody. So there's that. There's also Pakistan has decided now that the success of Afghanistan is no longer an interest of the United States. Pakistan has decided to just send something like 1.7 million Afghan refugees who've been living in Pakistan for decades in some cases, just send them home, which is a tremendously bruising thing for an already depressed economy. So I think it's important when we talk about what's going on in Afghanistan in the 2 years since liberation, frankly, they need to be, this might be giving away my biases there a little bit, but like, we can't discuss what's been happening in Afghanistan for the past 2 years without understanding that the United States, like, you know, took a dump on the front stoop when we left and chopped their legs off.
Yeah, there's three things to note about the like last regime's time. It was like, first of all, you had the government, which we which essentially, you know, people would bribe people for ministerial positions. They'd buy their positions and then funnel the money they'd get into Dubai or Qatar or wherever, and buy luxury apartments, and then when the government collapsed, they just filled their suitcases with money and went right to their luxury apartments they built abroad. There was virtually no interest in members in the government to make anything out of that, out of the country, make anything out of their responsibility. And second of all, you have the daily life. Under every bridge in Kabul, you had masses of heroin addicts just rotting away. You couldn't stay outside in town when it got dark. There was kidnappings, robberies, crime was rampant. Military.
This is in Kabul. This isn't out in the hinterlands. This is in Kabul specifically.
Everywhere, yeah. The like I said, unimaginably corrupt, full of crime. The police, military, everyone was bribable and corrupt. And then on top of that, the third thing, obviously, there was just an ongoing civil war. You had, when I was there the first time, you had a bomb attack once a week, once every 2 weeks. Last time I was there, you had two bomb attacks a day, roughly, on average.
Wow.
And so that was just the daily life there. And then now with the transition, you have a complete collapse of the economy, as you said correctly, that it wasn't a sustainable economy in the first place, and you've got some radical changes, and this is where the kind of double-edged sword comes in. So you have a ban on women's education, women's higher education. I think primary schools are still open, but you have a ban on women's higher education, which especially affects central urban women. If you went through Afghanistan before, even in the last regime, on the countryside, things were still very rural. With rural, I mean like no electricity, everything still living off of agriculture, which is probably the saving grace to some extent with the economy collapsing, you know, the crops still grow. It's a relatively fertile country if there was no war. A lot of the people on the countryside would not afford to go to school much anyways. And as far as I know, 80% of people lived in the countryside. So the main people affected are which I'm not saying it to make the, you know, make light of the problem, to make it less relevant. But the main people affected is a relatively small, you could say, urban elite that, you know, was basically cut off from higher education, especially the women, obviously. But money is lacking everywhere. There's money lacking in any kinds of education, any kinds of industry.
One of the formative articles in my understanding of the Afghan War is this extraordinary New Yorker article, I think came out about in 2021. It's called The Other Afghan Women. Which is the title. You can Google that, and I'd highly recommend that everyone read it. And it basically just talked about that distinction, the fact that 80% of Afghan people and Afghan women were in a rural environment where death from above was a constant threat, if not torture and theft from the Afghan government that we had set up. So yeah, there absolutely are women who are suffering real consequences in a few urban environments, and that is atrocious, and you know, we need to do what we can. But the fact is that for most Afghan women, they now live in an environment where their family and friends are much less likely to get blown up. And that is...
That is a big part of it. Another part of it, there is a video on YouTube that I can very that I can recommend. I think it's an op-ed, an op-doc by, was it The Atlantic? I'm not sure. It's called Swift Justice. And it shows like a Taliban courtroom. And it's about a woman who refuses to marry her brother-in-law after her husband died. Mm-hmm. And in, you could say, old tribal customs, a lot of the rural life is governed by Pashtunwali, which is like a Pashtun tribal code. In old days, the woman would often be treated like inheritance. So her husband would die and then she would be passed on to another member in his family. And that is not permitted in Sharia law, as far as I know. So in that case, she was going to be given to her brother-in-law, and her father actually went to court, and she was permitted by the judge to stay with her father and not get married to her brother-in-law. Right. So there's...
The progressive family law legal revolution that Taliban is bringing to Afghanistan is not a concept I'm familiar with.
Yeah, well, I mean, regardless of whether it's progressive or not, it is, in a sense, it is equal to some extent. It's the same law and order applied everywhere. That's obviously idealistic a bit. In practice, there's probably a lot of messiness going on. And you have to remember, there are problems that, you know, just some new form of government can't fix. The country has not really been a historically grown nation. It's always been a buffer zone between empires. It's never really, no regime could hold its rule in that area for long. It's just too many ethnicities, too many different tribes, and no common history, no common empire. You could say the fact that Afghanistan exists at all is only due to historically recent, you could say, Pashtun tribal empires. You could trace it back maybe to the 18th century with Ahmad Shah Durrani and these kind of people that broke off of the not sure, the Persians, Moguls, maybe both. I'm not an expert on that part of the history. So you kind of have problems that you can't just fix with a new form of government. But what you have is this new stability that, as far as I know, the opium trade has basically been ended. The drug addicts under the bridges that I mentioned earlier, they were basically put under what's called cold withdrawal.
Cold turkey, yeah.
Cold turkey. And I think my uncle told me a lot of these bridges now, for symbolic reasons, they've got libraries now. They've got like public bookshelves there.
And presumably mostly religious texts, but still.
Probably, yeah. So you've got that. As far as I know, you've got a radical reduction in all of the crime, the kidnappings, the theft, the problems you had there, the instabilities you had there. And there's an interesting documentary in Germany as well. I don't know, maybe they have good for English subtitles. I'm assuming most of your viewers are not fluent in German.
Probably not, no.
But it's by a channel called SDRGF. It speaks about a German girl, a German woman that visits her grandfather in Afghanistan. And he was always pro-education. He's not a Pashtun, as far as I know, and wanted her to get an education, wanted her to leave the country. And she left the country, I think, during the first Taliban regime. And she's shocked to hear that her grandfather supports the Taliban now. And the explanation was essentially that he had some land in the country. And during the 20 years of the last regime, other people were using his land, were occupying his land. He was kind of locked out of his own land. And just for the reason, because the others had good connections to the local police or had enough money to bribe them or whatever. And when the Taliban took over, especially when it comes to the courts, then, you know, like people with not a lot of money, they can't afford this opaque Western law system of getting a lawyer and dragging out a process for months and paying them more than you earn in a year. And you end up paying them, like, you go to Sharia court now and you pay them a dollar or something, and or half a dollar, and the decision is made within an hour. They'll read out some passages from the Quran, just have the judgment.
Well, that has a lot of potential downsides as well. Let's not,
of course. Yeah,
let's not. But what is interesting is, as I've tried to educate myself about Afghanistan, it is interesting that I think Western journalists are pretty safe there now, safer than they'd be in a lot of places that the U.S. is still occupying, like Iraq and Syria. That's one clear indication. It is fascinating just sort of looking at these narratives about Taliban failure be set up and then knocked down. In the direct aftermath in 2021, it's like, okay, well now the place is going to fall into a bigger civil war, was sort of the thing we were hoping for, and we were going to try and foster that. Thankfully, cooler heads prevailed, and we did not jump in on that. But you know, ISIS-K, you know, ISIS Khorasan was this big battle between the Taliban and ISIS Khorasan, and I'm having a difficult time avoiding the conclusion that Afghanistan is a much worse safe haven for ISIS-K under the Taliban than it was under the United States.
Could be. I have a very like conspiracy theorist view on ISIS in general. For whenever I hear ISIS in my head, it's just kind of like American chaos contractors.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go quite that far, but I think that the way that I think about it is, I think about it as a brand. It's okay. A brand that people choose to associate themselves with. Whereas we really want to imagine ISIS is still like being directed by a caliph, you know, I guess sitting in Idlib or something. But it is a scary brand that people choose to associate themselves with. My understanding is that there is actually an ISIS Khorasan that is based in Taliban or based in Afghanistan, or at least used to be. But what's fascinating is I remember very specifically the tempo of these ISIS-K attacks. When the Taliban took over, it was every week. You know, it seemed like every Friday there'd be a mosque bombing of some sort. Now it seems like it's kind of every month, and they're getting smaller. Instead of hundreds killed at Friday prayer, it's now like one person killed, two people injured, and it's obviously not something that a Western news source is ever going to come out and say. But it really seems like Afghanistan is experiencing something like real peace for the first time in almost half a century.
You could say that. I haven't gone back, so until I do that, I don't want to make some very decisive statements on these things. But you could argue for that, especially if you think of it, a lot of it is, for better and for worse, fear. You know, the Taliban don't have modern technologies, by Western standards, but they have something like Asabiya. They have, a kind of a warrior spirit, less of a fear of dying in combat and these kind of things. And so I think once they've taken office, there is a general sense of like, you don't mess with the government. And I think, you know, that kind of mindset in the general public probably makes it less attractive to join groups like ISIS. So it's probably, I can imagine them just kind of using up their current supply of fighters, but not having a very good time recruiting new ones. That's the impression I would have. When it comes to that.
There's just fascinating anecdotes that do sort of slip out. Do you remember this news story? I think it was about a year back. It was just about all of these depressed Talibs who are just like, oh man, I used to love running through the hills with my brothers fighting against, And now I'm sitting in a cubicle in Kabul and I have to figure out Excel sheets. Are you kidding me? So yeah, it is just fascinating, fascinating anecdotes.
And then I was reading... true. And like, dude, I'm not going to lie. I kind of feel that. I'd be of any use in warfare, but I mean, like, I kind of know what they're saying. Like, if you,
it's got to be rough to go from, you know, Ernest Hemingway lifestyle to the cubicle jockey thing that we're all used to. Yeah.
I mean, the landscape in Afghanistan is just beyond beautiful. You know, there's such amazing, beautiful areas. It's such amazing, beautiful food and different cultures and clothes and traditions. And yeah, it is, you know, traveling from different areas, obviously war is negative, but like being out in the wild and traveling different areas, it probably has some romanticism to it compared to sitting in a cubicle and getting calls all day about how some road is broken or whatever.
But it also, so I like, there's a couple, I guess we'll close, but there's just a couple articles that I've read. I remember, you know, a number of months back, The Economist, through gritted teeth, just like putting out this article, just like, yeah, things are terrible in Afghanistan because of this, this, and this, and this, but the Taliban actually seem to be pretty solid managers, and just sort of having to concede that. And I read a Washington Post article from, I guess, just a month or two back, or maybe it was last fall, was sort of a long read documenting the economic travails, but it was also, you know, a lot of economic problems that are largely not the Taliban's fault. It's not their fault that the U.S. won't recognize them. It's not their fault that the central bank was stolen. It's not their fault that Pakistan has decided to give them a refugee influx.
Or the earthquakes.
Or the earthquakes or the floods. It's just fascinating. The impression that I get is this is a government that is doing things. That is, you know, they like restarted a steel plant. They are opening
pipeline and canals, and I think the first railway ever.
Yeah, to Iran. If they can avoid falling into warfare with Iran. And one of the great lines, and this actually mirrors something I was reading about the Houthis in Yemen recently, is just that, like, people really hate that the Taliban makes them pay the taxes they were never paying. You know, it's an extremely strong indictment of whatever the heck the United States was doing there at the time.
But my favorite one was a recent one where it was the end of the global heroin trade is a bad thing. Actually, it was something that. Yeah, they were arguing that it was bad that the Taliban ended the global opium trade. And as far as I know, 90% of global opium came from Afghanistan or something. And the reason it was bad, I think it was a British media piece. The reason it was bad was that most of the heroin in London or in England is now like synthetic fentanyl-based stuff, which is way more dangerous. And I'm
if
just
the Taliban
wondering,
hadn't taken the heroin away from us, you know, none of this Chinese fentanyl would be killing us. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Just thinking, yeah. Like, can you take some responsibility for the problems you have in your own country?
That is not something we do in the English-speaking world when it comes to drug problems. We take no personal responsibility. It is all Mexico and Afghanistan's fault. Yeah. And now China's fault. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's interesting that the Taliban were just instantly successful in the heroin removal that was nominally
maybe the war on drugs people in the U.S. could get some Taliban consultants or something.
You know, I'm a little too much of a fan of the Bill of Rights to believe that would work out so well, but I do like our protections. And, you know, once upon a time I used to like drugs, so anyway, it is. Thank you so much for this conversation, for this rattling through this. You are a YouTube producer. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your channel?
I usually do stuff a bit different from this conversation. My channel is Deep Noetics. It's mainly focused on philosophy. I usually kind of have a certain topic I'm interested in, and then just interview people that speak about it. It's my excuse to talk to interesting YouTubers as yourself. And last year, it was mainly focused on technology. I was speaking a lot about philosophy of technology, drawing on a lot of philosophy, more focused as well on German philosophy, Kant, Heidegger, Nietzsche. And this year, it's more focused on power. So I've been reading different authors on power, Bertrand de Jouvenel, Foucault, Schmidt, others. And I teach courses if people are interested in checking out my courses. Philosophy of the Machine from last year is still up, and upcoming is the Philosophy of Power. And I kind of, I ended up getting interested in your channel as well when it came to power, because even though you're not a philosopher on power, you do speak of global power, you do speak of like global consolidation of power. And kind of in what you were saying resonated a lot with the kind of conception, the more philosophical conception of power I was getting. If you had to kind of use that to analyze how power works in practice and specific geopolitical questions, they'd be very similar to what you've been saying. And that's what got me interested. I think initially it was...
Oh, I'm happy to hear that I'm a philosopher, even though I don't understand any of it. So that's good. Good to know. Well, thank you so much, Sean. You can find Sean's work at Deep Noetics is the YouTube channel. I'm sure Rory's about to chime in with all of my plugs as well. Thank you all so much for being here, and thank you so much, Sean.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.